From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Richmond, California.
San Jose.
Union City.
Eastside.
Jackson.
I'm from the Campbell area.
Hayward.
Coming up, we'll hear about a young Richmond resident who's using accounting spreadsheets to get away from gun violence.
Every drug dealer is a businessman. You got expenses, you got revenue.
Then we'll meet the director of the new film, The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution.
They would observe the police to make sure no brutality occurred. And that was the beginning of the Black Panther Party.
And we explore what's kept the horoscope going in an age of cynicism.
So when I want to read a horoscope, it is coming from the desire to crack open a cookie and be told my fortune.
You will hear great radio in the near future on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Over the past decade, Richmond police have been trying different strategies to lower crime, from trying to strengthen bonds between officers and local communities to offering stipends to young men to stay out of trouble. They've even started the Office of Neighborhood Safety, a department separate from the police that tries to connect with residents in ways that the police department couldn't. Kevin Yarbrough is part of that group.
You know, a lot of people want to change, but they're not ready. You know, so we kind of function around their timetable, right? Whenever they get ready, we here.
But what is it like to make that change, to go from living on the edge of the law to trying to make a life within the system? In this piece from producers Sarah Kate Kramer and Joe Richman of the podcast Radio Diaries, we hear about one young man who went from dodging bullets to balancing spreadsheets. Here's Joe Richman.
Back in 2008, at the age of 13, Kamari Ridgel made the evening news in California.
I got caught with an SU-16 automatic, really like an assault rifle.
So yes, Kamari took an assault rifle to school. He had had an argument with another student, and the weapon was meant to help him make his point. He didn't pull the trigger that day, but over the next 2 years, he would. Today on the Radio Diaries podcast, From Bullets to Balance Sheets.
Childhood was a real childhood, but things got different around like 11, 12. That's when, you know, you really started to become personally involved in like a lot of the crimes or the fight. You really start to like choose sides of like, you know, being from North Richmond, Central, or South Richmond. So around this era, I think I was like 13. I started getting into shootouts. It was nothing for me to get in a car and say, let's go do a shooting.
How would a shootout happen? Like, how does it all begin?
But really, like, certain stuff like that go back generations, you know? And for the people who's in these shootings, it really means something to them because a lot of people out there, they done lost cousins, they done lost dads, they done lost uncles, they done lost brothers, sisters, you know, all behind a war that's been going on for almost 15 years. And it's just back and forth. Like, back and forth shootings.
Do you think in this period, did you kill anyone?
Nah.
You shoot anyone?
Could've shot somebody. I don't know. It was so many of us doing these shootings that it was just like, you know, whoever gonna claim it, let them claim it. But me, I'm keeping mine that I don't know. That's my answer.
Kamari was also a drug dealer, a pretty successful one for a teenager. But everything changed for him on May 27th, 2010. As he was walking home from a liquor store, Kamari was the target of a drive-by shooting.
When it happened, I just felt like I got hit by, like, some big fat dude. Like, some big dude just, like, hit me hard. Like, when people be like, blood tastes hot and salty and all that, that's all I can remember because it was, like, going down in my mouth. That's it.
Kamari was shot between 14 and 22 times that day.
One doctor I asked, he was like, oh, 14. Another doctor I asked, he's like, yeah, you got shot 22 times. Another doctor I asked, he was like, don't worry about it. Just be lucky to be alive.
Kamari was in a coma for 3 weeks. When he woke up, he found out he couldn't walk anymore. He was in a wheelchair. And he asked himself the obvious next question.
What I'm going to do?
You know, saying, what do I want to do in life?
Fast forward a few years, Kamari is now a student at Sacramento City College, and he's found the thing he wants to do for the rest of his life.
I plan to be a managerial accountant. That's the goal. I want to be able to get a bachelor's in science of accountancy. I want to be able to take the CPA exam.
I hope you don't mind me saying, but I can't think of two things that are more different in the world than drive-by shootings and being an accountant.
I'm going to blow your mind with this response, okay? Every drug dealer is a businessman. Last fall, in my accounting class, teacher was like, "That's what y'all really need to know. You got expenses, you got revenues." That's when I was just like, oh, I did this before. I get this. Let's say expense. Weed baggies, scales, razors, baking sodas. Those are all expenses. You driving around selling weed? That gas, that $25 in gas, that's an expense. So I balanced my revenues minus my expenses. That was my profit. You know, spend $250, make $500. That's part of being a businessman. You never know when you in that street life that you really doing this. But when you sit down and you transition your life and say, hey, I want to do something positive, and then you match what you did in the streets to what you can do in a positive way, you say, nah, this fits. I don't look at accounting work as work. I look at accounting work as having fun. I'm counting your money, you know? That's a joy for me. Don't get me wrong, I'm still from the hood, but I'm just not out there. I don't want to bother nobody, you know? I just want to live my simple life and just do what I like to do, make money. So I'm going to go out there and do whatever I want to do. I just know it ain't got to do with like me really being in the way of a police officer. You may say that's weird, but hey, at least I ain't out there shooting somebody.
When I interviewed Kamari, the question in my mind was, how is it possible that a guy who would go around shooting people because they were from a different side of town is now happiest alone in a room with Microsoft Excel? The truth is, it doesn't really matter. What does matter is there's one less guy doing drive-by shootings and one more guy out there to do your taxes.
That piece was produced by Sarah Kate Kramer and Joe Richmond for Radio Diaries. Check out their podcast at radiodiaries.org or find a link at klw.org. Click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Kamari Ridgel went into accounting to simplify his life and get away from guns and police. About 50 years ago, some other Bay Area residents found empowerment by picking up guns. The Black Panthers started in North Oakland in the fall of 1966. Their very visible public presence marked a change of pace during the civil rights movement.
The state assembly was in the midst of a heated debate when the young Negroes, armed with loaded rifles, shotguns, and pistols, marched into the Capitol.
That's from the new film, The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution, by director Stanley Nelson. Nelson is a MacArthur Genius Fellow who's made documentaries about the civil rights movement, the American Indian movement, and Jonestown. He spoke with KLW's Ben Trefney about what made the Black Panthers so influential.
How did the Black Panthers form?
The Black Panthers were formed in 1966 in Oakland, California. And because at that time in California, you could carry a loaded weapon as long as it was out in the open, they said, okay, that's our rights under the California law. We'll do that. And they basically followed the police. They policed the police. They would follow the police around with another group of guys. And when the police would jump out and make a stop, they would jump out behind the police. And as they said, they would observe the police to make sure no brutality brutality occurred. And that was the beginning of the Black Panther Party.
So Huey P. Newton, he was really aware of these laws, and he talked about that. He promulgated it.
The California Penal Code, Section 12020 through 12027, and also the Second Amendment of the Constitution guarantees the citizen a right to bear arms on public property.
Yeah, he was actually taking some law classes and just happened to come upon this law and realize that that was something that was legal.
Well, at the time, many people in established government saw the Black Panthers as a serious threat.
I don't think that loaded guns is the way to solve a problem that should be solved between people of goodwill.
We've got to protect society from nuts with guns.
When bands of armed people with loaded weapons can move about our streets intimidating and frightening citizens, then I think we should act, and we intend to act.
Was there justifiable concern about public safety for these actions the Panthers were taking?
There were no shootouts or no violence because of the policing, the police activity at all in Oakland, California.
So in your movie, you talk with several members of the Black Panthers. You talk with members of law enforcement and several historians. One of them is Claiborne Carson, and he described the Black Panthers' leadership in this way.
Huey Newton always had this vision. He was the visionary of the party. Bobby Seale, he had the personality. Eldridge Cleaver was the person who made the party credible to the white left intellectuals. You know, all of them loved Eldridge Cleaver. They understood what he was talking about, or at least they thought they did.
So I wonder if you could tell me more about these three men. Tell me about who Huey Newton was.
Well, Huey Newton was a college student. I think he was a little older. He might have been 24 or so. And he was a college student. He was from Oakland. He was known to kind of have a very volatile personality. But he's the one person I would have loved to have met. I mean, you know, because Huey was in some ways a genius, you know, a very, very, very brilliant guy.
Mm-hmm. And then how about Bobby Seale?
Well, Bobby Seale, again, was a little bit old. I think Bobby Seale might have been 27. He had bounced around. He was in college. He had been an entertainer. You know, there's nobody who didn't love Bobby Seale. There's probably no one who doesn't love Bobby Seale to this day. He and Huey were the founders of the party.
And then Eldridge Cleaver joined the party. Tell me about him.
Well, Eldridge Cleaver joins the party, and, you know, he had just gotten out of prison. He had written this book, Soul on Ice, which at the time he joins the Panthers is actually on the New York Times bestseller list. It's one of the top 10 books in the country.
He's a celebrity.
Yeah, he's a celebrity because it was this prison. It was this guy who had written these essays in prison that the New York Times says are brilliant. They, you know, everybody's reading this book. And so they get this kind of celebrity, this star who joins the Panthers. And it just brings more notoriety to the Panthers because they're like, well, why did he join? Who are these people?
Mm-hmm. Eldridge Cleaver once challenged then-Governor Ronald Reagan to a fight.
And I say that Ronald Reagan is a punk, a sissy, and a coward, and I challenge him to a duel. I challenge him. I challenge him to a duel. He could use a gun, a knife, a baseball bat, or a marshmallow, and I'll beat him to death with a marshmallow. That's how I feel about him, see?
Well, what kind of relationship did the Black Panthers have with the governor? I mean, how did the governor see them too?
Well, he saw them as a threat. I mean, and that's one of the funny things in the film, because the Panthers invade the California legislature with their guns, and Ronald Reagan is there. Actually, he's there on the lawn talking to a group of parochial students, and the press turns away from Ronald Reagan and just follows the Panthers, and then by a series of crazy accidents, the Panthers actually end up with their guns on the floor of the California state legislature while it's in session, and it becomes this just media circus in this media event. And that's one of the ways that the Panthers become noticed by the whole country. And J. Edgar Hoover at this point, you know, he says that the Black Panthers are the greatest internal threat to the security of America. And that really unleashes the local police departments and the FBI against them. Because if they are the greatest internal threat, then they have to be destroyed. You know, and local police were like, okay, you know, if this is the biggest threat to our country and they're in my city, then I have to, you know, help destroy them.
So how have the situations that the Black Panthers were mobilizing against changed? And how are they the same?
Well, I think that, you know, there's lessons, good and bad, to be learned from the Panther story. I mean, the Panthers were great at using the media and seizing the media. I mean, I think one of the things that makes the film work is that the Panthers were such media darlings. I think that what they weren't good at is rooting out informers, rooting out the, you know, these kind of agent provocateurs who were pushing the Panthers to buy guns and actually getting them guns, who were FBI agents. And they weren't good at kind of working with the internal squabbles that come up in any organization. You know, you have to have a way to resolve those conflicts. So I think, you know, there's lessons good and bad to be learned.
A lot of the things that the Black Panthers focused on, they had a 10-point program, and a lot of the things they talked about are really issues that we're thinking about today, especially in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. Affordable housing, police brutality, having, you know, good education.
That's everywhere in this country.
Yeah, is that one of the reasons why you decided to make this movie now?
Oh, I started the movie like 7 years ago when I wrote the first proposal. And I started it because I thought it was relevant. You know, I mean, I'm not interested in devoting, you know, 7 years of my life to making a film that's kind of like, you know, lives in a historical bubble. That's like, oh, yeah, that was nice. You know, let's go get a hamburger. You know, but it has something to do with today. Little did I know that it would have as much to do with today and be right in the forefront of so many people's minds as it came to be.
That was director Stanley Nelson talking about his new film, The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. He spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney. The film is currently showing around the Bay Area. We'll show you where at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Chances are that at some point in your life, you've been asked the question, what's your sign? That phrase is both a terrible pickup line and proof that astrology is still a big thing in popular culture. And the most popular manifestation of astrology? The horoscope. Open almost any newspaper in the country, and you're likely to find your daily, weekly, or monthly horoscope. But not all astrologers are fans of this condensed version of astrology. They feel that outlining a person's fate requires more than just the few short sentences horoscopes are known for. But the newspapers keep printing horoscopes, and people keep flipping through newspapers just to get to them. KLW's Holly J. McDeed called out to the celestial bodies and to the Bay Area's horoscope writers to find out what keeps this ancient sorcery going.
When I worked as an editor at my college newspaper, there were always empty pages to fill. Every week, we had a choice to make. Sudoku or crossword puzzles? Crossword puzzles or Sudoku? Then one night, I looked out at the night sky and then turned to my computer screen. I spent roughly 20 minutes learning about sun signs and began typing frantically. And so began my column, Horoscopes for the Miserable.
According to the multi-universe theory, every time we make a decision, we create another universe. So next time you think about making a decision, you might want to decide not to.
For ages, people have looked to the heavens to understand the world. The first horoscope texts were discovered in ancient Babylonia, shortly after 500 BC, when the idea of zodiac symbols first emerged in Greece. One of the earliest horoscopes goes like this.
If a child is born when the moon comes forth, his situation will be bright, good, stable, and long. If a child is born and Saturn comes forth, his situation will be dark, troubled, sick, and constrained.
Since then, horoscope writers, like myself, have continued to foretell future happiness and occasionally predict doom. And since then, astrologers like Nora Jean Stone have called baloney.
Will sun sign horoscopes in magazines and newspapers disappear? No. Do I know of people who have been hired to write those things who knew nothing about astrology? Yes.
Stone, the director of publicity and outreach for the San Francisco Astrological Society, is on to me, and the other accidental horoscope writers out there like me. She's even doubtful of actual astrologers who write horoscopes.
It's a matter of how much space are you going to give these articles. It's usually a filler. It's not that deep.
See, the signs many of us know by heart, like Geminis or Tauruses, are only based on the position of the sun. And that's what most horoscope writers rely on. So when astrologer Jessica Lignato was asked to write a horoscope column, she was skeptical.
I never thought I would write a weekly horoscope because it's schlocky. It's a schlocky practice. People have this idea of astrology and psychic and palm reading, and it's all this big crystal ball, crushed velvet, scary or hokey thing.
But she also saw horoscope columns as a way to connect with a wider audience.
And I feel that, you know, a well-written or accurate sun sign horoscope can really do a lot to build a bridge between a person having these kind of like outdated, limited, uneducated beliefs and developing an interest to actually do research and know more.
You don't really need to know anything about astrology to read a horoscope, which is good, because astrology is one complicated machine. I asked Lignato to explain the process of writing a horoscope. So let's say she wants to write a horoscope for a Gemini.
I mean, I have this process of looking at where all the planets were in that particular week from the perspective of the constellation of Gemini. So in that case, and then I also bring in my intuition. That's the spiritual side of how I come to the content.
So the sun, the moon, and the planets all travel along a set path. During their travels, they pass through 13 constellations. Gemini, Aries, Pisces, Sagittarius, those are all examples of these constellations. Lignato takes a look at where the planets fall within each constellation and in relation to other planets, interprets what she sees, and translates this information into a horoscope column. For example,
Aries, this month may light some fire under your ass to make you feel hecka entitled, so pace yourself wisely to avoid my love.
Lignato's horoscopes now appear in Nasty Gal magazine and on her own website. She's been writing them for over a decade, but she still doesn't see herself as a writer.
People who are poets or writers, people who love writing, may have a kind of romantic sense of childbirth in this way, of like pushing it out, and it's like something that you give birth to and it's beautiful, but I'm a woman who doesn't want to give birth, so to me, the pushing it out is not super fun.
Unlike Lignato, horoscope writer Rob Bresny loves to write, and he approaches horoscopes like poetry. For him, astrology was another way to try and understand people.
My soul was starving, and so I turned to music and I turned to astrology as ways to take the edge off the headiness that I was developing.
And with every horoscope, he has a not-so-secret agenda.
I'm continually asking people to change what it is about themselves, to investigate what it is about themselves that makes them less tolerant of others. And it's an incremental, bit-by-bit, look-at-yourself kind of medicine.
Bresny's horoscopes are like bite-sized fables, the kind you have to sit down to read and dissect, slowly, word by word. I've been reading his horoscopes for the past 5 years now, and sometimes they make sense. So when I forgot to get my mom a birthday gift this year, I decided to call her and read her one of Bresny's horoscopes instead, hoping that it might lead to blissful self-discovery. Here's what Bresny wrote for Leo's.
What are the best things and the worst things in your life, and when are you going to get around to whispering or shouting them?
Well, she hadn't hung up yet, and I had a feeling she was listening closely.
This is one of those times when working with your extremes is not only safe and healthy, but also fun and inspirational.
And then came the call to action, wrapped like a birthday gift with a tidy bow on top.
So do it, Leo. Get excited and expressive about the best and worst things in your life.
At this, my mom exclaimed, "It's true, it's true. I do need to get excited and expressive. How did you know?" I explained that Rob Bresny knew. not me. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
So, do you have a fortune for us? What does tomorrow hold? We'd love to hear all about it, or just give us your story suggestions at news@kalw.org, or give us a call at 415-264-7106 and leave a message. That's 415-264-7106. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Angela Johnston, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, Truk Nguyen, Edwin Okongo, James Rollins, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Jeremy Dalmas. Our managing editor is Jen Sheehan. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by San Francisco musician Alex Condi, who plays flamenco on piano. Condi has a free lunchtime concert on Friday at the Cadillac Hotel in San Francisco starting at 12:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.